You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon and welcome, everybody, to this event on the case for radical banking reform. And I'm delighted to introduce my friend, Larry Kotlikoff, a friend of many, many years. We were classmates together, so I will not tell you how long we've known each other. Larry is...
Since the Middle Ages.
Since the Middle Ages. Is professor of economics at Boston University. He is, of course, one of the best-known, most prominent macroeconomists. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, fellow of the Econometric Society. He was a senior economist on the President's Council of Economic Advisors. He has done wide-ranging work in macroeconomics, best known perhaps for his work on generational accounting, which began a long time ago when he was a graduate student, and working with Martin Feldstein. But today's topic is based on his book with the, in my view, unlikely title, Jimmy Stewart is Dead. This book was just very recently published. You can find it on Amazon. And it makes the argument for a radical reform of the way banking is conducted. To discuss Larry's presentation and the book, I'm delighted to welcome a colleague from a much younger institution than the Carnegie Endowment, the Brookings Institution, here next door. And Doug was an investment banker for two decades, principally at J.P. Morgan. So in addition to his scholarly work, he brings enormous practical experience to the issue of banking reform. And he has done a lot of work on both public and private financial institutions. So he is admirably qualified to comment on Larry's presentation. We're hoping to have one or two more people come who may also be adding to the discussion. I'll tell you when and if they arrive. So I think without further ado, I'm going to ask Larry to present for about 20 minutes, and then Doug to follow with discussions and commentary, and then we'll open it up. I very much hope there's an important soccer game on tonight for those of you who are European inclined, and so I very much hope we can certainly get out of here a little before 7. Larry.
Is the U.S. playing?
No, the U.S. is not playing. Europe really needs a boost today, I tell you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for coming, and thanks, Yuri, for setting this up. So Yuri described what I'm going to propose as a radical banking reform. I would say it's actually a safe banking reform. I would say that the status quo is a radical banking situation. The reality is that we've seen the impossible happen. We've seen pretty much the collapse of a good chunk of the banking system, and things that were just unbelievable occurred, as you know. I think we're in an even more risky position right now. I think what's happened is that the U.S. government has seen what AIG did and has taken over that role and become AIG to the 10th power. I'll just give you a nightmare scenario. Let's suppose that the public starts to understand that the U.S. is in worse fiscal shape than Greece. the Chinese start to dump U.S. bonds, interest rates start to go up, people start to realize that the only way the U.S.'s government is going to deal with its fiscal problems is to print money. And just suppose we would have a run on the banks, on the U.S. banks, as hard to believe as that is. That's a small probability event. But again, the impossible to believe and imagine has just happened. So let's imagine something else that's, quote, impossible to believe. Suppose there was a run on the banks this tomorrow morning. The FDIC would have to print about $6 trillion because that's what their obligations are. They have about $18 billion in reserves, last time I looked. Then the government would have to print another, not the FDIC, but the Fed would have to print the $6 trillion for the FDIC. The Fed would then have to print about $3 trillion to cover the money market accounts because they would surely be run on the minute after the banks were run on. Then there'd be a run on the cash surrender values of the life insurance policies, which are about $3 trillion. Then the U.S. government has all kinds of obligations that it's committed to cover, which run in the tens of, you know, perhaps, I don't know, somewhere maybe around $10 trillion. We could quickly see the printing of over $10 trillion. Everybody would therefore expect hyperinflation to arise. Therefore, everybody would run on the banks, would want to run on the banks, because if you didn't get your money out right away, you would end up with your dollars because they're, quote, insured, but you wouldn't have your purchasing power, which is not insured. The FDIC insurance is really a myth. It's a fraud. It's a convenient fraud, and it's worked for a long time, but it's not actually real. And when the government has spent the last 2 years guaranteeing everything left, right, and center, making commitments that it can't really cover, then it's really acting like AIG, which is insuring the uninsurable. That, to me, is a very risky position because it could lead to complete meltdown of the financial sector and of the U.S. economy. So that's risky. What I'm proposing is safe. What I'm proposing is that we transform the banks and any other financial institution that has limited liability. I'm drawing a line in the sand, not the way Paul Volcker is drawing a line, which is between commercial banks and investment banks, or good banks and bad banks, but between companies that have limited liability, financial intermediaries with limited liability, and those without it. Any financial intermediary, whether it calls itself a bank, a commercial bank, or an investment bank, or a hedge fund, or a private venture capital fund, or an insurance company, any of those companies that have limited liability or organized as corporations or as LLPs would have to operate in one way and one way only, which is as mutual fund companies. So they would sell mutual funds. The mutual funds themselves are 100% equity financed in all states of nature. There's never any liability that goes beyond the resources of the mutual fund. And therefore, the mutual funds themselves can never fail. The mutual fund companies, the holding companies, the mutual fund parent, like the Fidelity Investments or the TI Crafts or T. Rowe Price, these mutual fund companies themselves can't fail because they're just borrowing to run their mutual fund business, to build, to buy computers and desks and buildings to run their business, but they're not borrowing to invest in risky assets. That would be precluded. So you have, under what I'm proposing, a financial system that is immune from collapse. It can never fail. You can never have financial collapse again. Financial collapse and bankruptcy has been the hallmark of a lot of major recessions and even the Great Depression in our country. And that would not arise under limited purpose banking. So we would go to a safe system where the banking system and the insurance system play the role of honest intermediaries, connecting people that have funds to invest or to lend to those who are trying to borrow and invest. Yeah, those who are savers or and are willing to to give their money to other people who want to borrow or invest. So this is what Mervyn King has called for. He's called for utility banking as the way the banking system should be organized. And limited purpose banking is a form of utility banking. There's a feature of limited purpose banking which goes back to the narrow banking proposal that was presented by Frank Knight and Irving Fisher and Henry Simons back in the 1930s in what was called the Chicago Plan. And what they were saying is that we should have deposits fully reserved. There should be 100% reserves against deposits. Well, narrow banking, that part of that aspect of that would be one aspect of limited purpose banking, but it's really a narrow aspect of limited purpose banking, because one of the mutual funds that the limited purpose mutual fund companies would be offering on the market would be cash mutual funds, which hold just cash, 100% invested in cash. And I'm talking about cash, not talking about treasury bills, treasury bonds. I'm talking about a cash mutual fund that holds cash. Now, that would be the only mutual fund that would be back to the buck, because there would be a dollar there for every dollar that's put in, except for the fee that the cash mutual fund would charge for holding your cash. That cash mutual fund would be the counterpart of the checking accounts that we have in our current system. So that would be the payment system. We'd be using the cash mutual funds for the payment system. We would be able to write checks on our cash mutual fund. We'd be able to get our cash out of our cash mutual funds using debit cards. We'd be able to get cash out of ATM machines, drawing on our cash mutual funds. Every other mutual fund would float in the marketplace. Nothing would be back to the buck. Every prospectus would say, this fund is risky and is not back to the buck. That would be in big letters at the very top of the fund prospectus. The other type of mutual fund that would arise here would be insurance mutual funds. I'm just saying the other type that's not already there. We have to realize that a third of the financial system today is mutual funds. Mutual funds hold a third of the financial assets. So this glass here, financial system, is a third full already. I'm trying to fill it up all the way to the top. If you think about the financial crisis, there were a lot of glasses. The ones that are all broken were not the mutual fund companies. By the way, I don't work for any mutual fund company. I'm not on anybody's payroll. I don't do any consulting for them. Just to know, so you know, I'm not a shill for the mutual fund industry. I think a lot of what they're doing sucks, to put it technically, in terms of their fee disclosure and their disclosure about what they're holding. So just to be clear, I think they need to, there's some reforms that have to be occur there as well. But if you look at this financial earthquake that we just had, some of these glasses are still standing. The rest are in pieces. And we want to rebuild. What the Congress is up to right now is to rebuild the shattered pieces in the same material. They want to rebuild in straw when there was concrete that was used, and that stood up. Most of us have most of our assets in mutual funds. So for most of us, our banking system is mutual funds. You got to realize that most of us are middle class and lower income, and we have most of our assets in retirement accounts, and retirement accounts are held in mutual funds, or we invest in mutual funds. When Congress set up the 401k system, it made sure that it was set up in a way that the middlemen would not be able to steal our money. So there's third-party custody, and there's certainly much better disclosure with mutual funds than there are in the rest of the financial system. Now, that's one part of what this proposal entails. The other part is a single regulatory agency, which is called the Federal Financial Authority, which would make sure that all the securities that the mutual funds hold and buy and sell are verified by this federal agency. That's to say, the income statements and employment statements, any other statement on these securities would be verified by the single federal agency. The collateral values would be appraised by this federal agency, which would hire independent appraisal companies, companies that are not conflicted. What we saw in this financial crisis was the sale of snake oil. We saw liar loans where people lied about their income, they lied about the appraised value of the collateral, and they manufactured $2 to $3 trillion in what are now called toxic assets. We don't know how much of that $2 trillion or $3 trillion of subprime securitized mortgage debt is actually toxic or not, because it wasn't disclosed. Anyway, this federal financial authority would verify all these income statements. It would get the appraisal done correctly. It would hire companies to independently rate the paper, so we wouldn't have insider rating. And it would require third-party custody, which is required for all mutual fund companies under the 1940 Investment Company Act. And then it would disclose all information about the securities on the web in real time. So if Yuri comes to my mutual fund company, my limited purpose bank, if you like, to borrow money, what I would do is process the paperwork. I'm Citigroup. I have been transformed into exclusively a mutual fund company. My investment banking business has turned into a consulting business. My trading business has turned into a matching of buyers and sellers. I've got no exposure. And my commercial banking has been turned into a mutual fund business. So Yuri needs a loan to buy a house from Doug. He comes to me. I take his application. I send it to, your name is?
Tom.
I send it to Tom, who's the head of the Federal Financial Authority. Tom's going to check Yuri's income statements based on federal tax returns. He's going to send out appraisers to double-check the appraised value of the house. He's going to get Yuri's paper rated. And then he's going to disclose it all on the web, and he's going to send it back to me. And then I'm going to put it up for auction to my mutual fund, who's investing in mortgages in this part of Washington, this part of the country, and other mutual fund companies who are investing in mortgages. And this mortgage will get funded, and Yuri will get to buy the house, and the money will go from, once it's funded, it will go from you know, my mutual fund, whichever mutual fund buys the mortgage, the money will get wired to Doug because he's handing over the house. So Citigroup itself, as a holding company, is never holding any liability here. It's not got no exposure at any point in time. And the credit then is going from whoever invested in this mutual fund that gets the bid. Let's say that's, your name is?
John.
John invested in a mutual fund that, what's your name?
Rand.
Rand? So Rand set up a mutual fund with Deutsche Bank. You successfully bid. You got Tom to invest in your mutual fund. You're providing credit to Yuri through Tom's mutual fund. So there's credit provision. We already have mutual funds, 8,000 mutual funds in this country that are investing in mortgages, they're investing in treasury bills and in TIPS, inflation index bonds, are investing in cash. There are cash mutual funds already. They're investing in equities from all over the world, index funds or Pacific Basin. They're investing in junk bonds. It's already happening. Financial intermediation is going on through mutual funds as it is, and they didn't collapse. They're not in shattered pieces. Now, the insurance companies here, I'll tell you about the insurance companies, and I'm going to turn things back over to Doug to say why all this is impossible, perhaps, or
just most.
Most. And then I'll tell you why it's possible. What's really impossible is keeping the system going when you have a $600 trillion derivatives market, and you could set whatever capital requirements you want. All it takes is one trader who's not sufficiently babysat by one regulator of the 120 regulatory bodies we're going to end up with, after the new legislation. All that one trader has to do is make some trade for $1 trillion or so with a couple keystrokes, and bingo, we'll have a company like Citigroup owing $1 trillion. It'll be too big to fail, and bingo, the U.S. taxpayer will be out $1 trillion. That's a lot of money. That's the kind of thing that can bring the market, the economy, to a standstill like it's been brought. I think I need to tell you two things. I need to tell you about the insurance mutual funds, and I need to tell you about the Tylenol scare in 1984, and then I'm going to be quiet. The insurance mutual funds would work like this. Let's suppose that we're all young females of a certain age and we're trying to buy life insurance, and we all have passed a certain medical exam, and that's the kind of thing that would insurance company now require to buy life insurance. You take some kind of a test. They come and give you some blood test and so forth, and check your heart rate and so forth. So we're all young, middle-aged females, let's say, and we put our money into Tom's, not Tom's, your name is? Peter's life insurance mutual fund run by John Hancock. And it's a 3-month closed-end fund. We give him our money, and the money's invested in Treasury bills. 3 months later, the Treasury bill money, you know, the Treasuries are there plus interest, less Tom, Peter's fee. That's the pot. And those of us who die get to collect the pot less the fee in proportion to what we put in. That's to say that our survivors get to collect because we're going to be dead. But those of us who didn't die collect nothing. Now, that's an insurance pool. The ones who die win. They lose in the sense that they win in the sense that they get paid off. The ones who live lose. They get nothing. A longevity pool is where we put money in this in a mutual fund, and the bet is on whether or not we survive. Those of us who survive get to collect out of the pool. Those of us who die lose, get nothing. Now, think about the life insurance pool. If more people die, the pot is the same. Less is going to be paid out per decedent. So there's no attempt to insure aggregate risk, which is what we have under the current system. The current system has life insurance industry saying that we will cover your policy. We'll pay you off your life insurance face value of your policies no matter how many people die. If swine flu were to break out and kill 2.5% of the policyholders of American life insurance companies, not only would it kill millions of people, but it would kill the insurance industry, which would probably bring down the rest of the financial system. The insurance industry is sitting with, as I mentioned, $3 trillion in cash surrender value that could be run on tomorrow. If people start to realize that the insurance companies only have $8 billion in reserves in their state reserve funds to cover trillions upon trillions of dollars of life insurance liability, and that they've insured the uninsurable, that they've played AIG's game, there can be a run right away on those cash surrender values, and the insurance industry can go down at the same time all these people die. What I'm proposing is no insurance of aggregate risk. The other type of insurance policy that would, so all these policies I've mentioned here, life insurance, longevity insurance, you could run car insurance, health insurance, homeowners insurance, all through what are called what's really a tontine structure. This insurance structure dates back to the 1600s. It lasted for several hundred years. The first physical location of the New York Stock Exchange was the Tontine Coffee House. So this is ancient finance and modern finance combined. Let me tell you about another ancient type of financial instrument, which is called the parimutuel fund. If you go to the racetrack, you're engaged in, you're investing in a mutual fund during the course of the race, whose structure was developed in 1857. It's been used for betting at racetracks around the world since then. And we would have people betting. Let's suppose that all of us wanted to bet on whether or not IBM defaults over the course of this year. So we come to, your name is?
Ben.
Ben sets up a IBM defaults or not mutual fund, closed-end mutual fund. It closes on January 1st, 2011. We invest, and we put our money down, and we give him our money, and at the end, it's invested in treasuries, one-year treasuries. At the end of the year, those of us who invested on the basis of IBM defaults will collect if IBM actually defaults. If it doesn't default, we'll collect the pot in proportion to how many of us there are and what we invested into the pot. And if it doesn't default, the rest of us will collect the pot. That's what's called a CDS. That's a credit default swap. But that's a credit default swap in which there's no liability to any third party. The taxpayer is not responsible for the losses of the people that lost out in that bet. You can have the bet being on whether or not IBM stock goes above 50. That's an option. You can have the money that we give to Ben can set up a CDO mutual fund where the money is put in. He invests the money in mortgages. Different ones of us take different tranches. At the end of a certain period, we're paid out. And there's nothing wrong with securitization. There's nothing wrong with modern financial instruments. What's wrong is the fraud and the fact that there's no firewalls. So I'm trying to set up a financial intermediary system here in which there are natural firewalls, where there's no contagion that can spread from one financial institution to another. Right now, we have a financial system that has, when one financial institution has a fire, there's a line of gas from one to the other. And then Uncle Sam really comes in and starts kind of spraying gas around to try and put out the fire to a large extent in guaranteeing things that it can't really guarantee. So that's the basic proposal. Let me now tell you about the Tylenol scare and explain why transparency is very important and disclosure is very important. In 19, I think it was 84, seven people died in Chicago because a few bottles of Tylenol out of the 30 million bottles worldwide were tainted with cyanide. And suddenly, this market for 30 million bottles of Tylenol had no buyers. Suddenly, we had this asset, which was 30 million bottles of Tylenol, which were perceived to be toxic, right? And now, what happened is that Johnson & Johnson took back all 30 million bottles at the cost of $100 million, threw it all away, started with 30 million new bottles, put in new Tylenol, and then put safety seals on the containers. In doing this, they were disclosing that the stuff inside those bottles was actually Tylenol and not cyanide. The problem was not that there were toxic assets. The problem was that there was not a disclosure that these particular bottles were full of cyanide. There's nothing wrong with people being able to buy cyanide. They may need it to kill rats. So if you go to a drugstore and it says cyanide on the bottle, perfectly fine. If you go to and it says Tylenol in these bottles, perfectly fine. It's when you go and you see a bottle that says Tylenol and it's actually got cyanide in it, that's when you have a problem. That's what this industry has done. This industry has manufactured systematically trillions of dollars of poison that they put into bottles, and they labeled it as pain relief or as, you know, as AAA when in fact they were CCC securities. We don't know the real extent. We may never know the extent to which this industry engaged in fraud. Just like we don't know how many of those 30 million bottles actually had cyanide. It could well be it was only a few bottles in Chicago. But you see, the information problem here can lead to this kind of collapse in the market. From one minute to the next, Johnson & Johnson's asset was worth nothing, just like Lehman Brothers' asset was worth nothing, just like Jimmy Cain's, Bear Stearns' asset was worth nothing, because the only person that knew about Bear Stearns' assets and liabilities was Jimmy Kane. And suddenly, from one day to the next, people decided that this was a guy who smoked dope, who played golf, played bridge, and wasn't really on top of what his bank was doing. And it went down. And then Dick Fold's bank went down. And then all the other ones that also went down went down. Let me stop there and get beat up by Doug, and then I'll respond.
Thank you very much. Larry, Doug, please.
Yeah, sure. First of all, I mean, it's an honor to be here today at the Carnegie Endowment and to have a chance to talk about Professor Kotlikoff's fascinating proposals. I have to start by confessing that it's somewhat intimidating to be as negative as I'm about to be about a book that has blurbs from five Nobel Prize winners, positive blurbs, and whose author is a brilliant man in his own right. Unfortunately, not every brilliant theory works in the real world, and I'm afraid that I think much of the proposal here does not work, as I'll explain in terms of my views. But let me start by applauding his passion, his eloquence. It's a great read if you haven't read the book, his brilliance, and his willingness to go for the bold solution. He's certainly right that the financial crisis we just went through was morally unacceptable and revealed a host of problems that we have to resolve. The problem, from my point of view, is just I don't think his answers are workable on the whole, at least as proposed in the book. And I should say he's written in other forums. I haven't had a chance to go over those, so I'm just going to focus on what was in the book itself. Now, I want to be careful not to take cheap shots here. His ideas are sweeping in scope, and they would clearly need a great deal of additional work to be a true detailed proposal. So it's easy for me to see what I think, at least, are major implementation problems, but perhaps a later iteration of these ideas might prove to be feasible. The good news is it's useful to have such a strong challenge to conventional thinking, and it may be that pieces of his proposal would be useful, even if I'm right about the larger set of problems. Okay, well, why am I not as enamored of Professor Kotlikoff's work as his Nobel-carrying fans are? Three things, really, and then I'll describe them in more detail. First, he would give up some major advantages of our current system that I believe he considerably underestimates the value of. Second, with a few exceptions, he generally compares his plan, at least in the book, with the very flawed system that spawned the current financial crisis. That's too easy a test. Almost any new theoretical approach would exceed that hurdle. We had total disaster. Worse, I believe that many of the problems he cites would remain issues under the new system unless we took additional actions which could well be taken under the present system. Third, I believe that he dramatically underestimates the transition risks. Financial intermediaries are central to our economy, as we've just seen when they stop working well. His changes would be a massive transformation, and we could suffer significantly if it turns out he's wrong on some points, or even if he's right, but it takes us collectively a while to figure out how to operate in a post-Kotlikoff world. So let me start with the first set of points, explaining why I think there are a few advantages here of the present system that are well worth keeping, and therefore I would see the change as being a major loss. First is fundamental to the theory of financial intermediation. It's something called maturity transformation. And Professor Kotlikoff does talk about this. Let me just make clear what it is we're talking about here. Most individuals and businesses have at least a substantial portion of their money that they want to have in what they feel is an ultra-safe and ultra-liquid asset, a checking account or a savings account where you can get money very quickly. On the other hand, most of the things that we need the money for to build America are longer-term investments. So we've got a mismatch between where most of the money is on the maturity spectrum and where we need it to be. So to some extent, banks were invented to do this maturity transformation. Now, why does it work, at least the vast majority of the time? It works because while people need to know they can get the money on short notice. On any given day, they don't take the money out. So under normal circumstances and absent a bank run, most of the money is actually quite stable so that banks are able to take that and make investments with it that are of longer term. So Professor Kotlikoff has addressed this, but at least in the book, he dispenses with the value of this maturity transformation by asserting that no government can guarantee the purchasing power of the deposits if we are faced with a surge of inflation. The comment puzzles me, and I'm sure he'll take the opportunity to explain it after I finish, but it puzzles me because the FDIC generally gives depositors access to their funds very quickly, sometimes over the weekend, and that's just not a lot of time for hyperinflation to set in. So that in itself doesn't seem like a very convincing rationale for dismissing maturity transformation. Now, there's a stronger negative that we're aware of, which is that this only works if everybody doesn't show up one morning and take the money out. The classic bank run that Jimmy Stewart had to deal with in the movie that is referred to in the book. That's why we have deposit insurance. On the other hand, deposit insurance does raise certain moral hazard issues and could ultimately lead to some taxpayer losses. I'd certainly be interested in looking at a balancing of the advantages of the maturity transformation, which I think are considerable, with the disadvantages of the deposit insurance, but that's not in the book anyway. I think it's an important enough issue that it needs to be considered. Second, credit for businesses. I noted only two paragraphs, literally, about lending to business in the entire book, plus a few references where he makes clear that this would be included in the proposal, as he described as well here. In my view, this is a serious defect because his proposals would be considerably harder to implement effectively for business credit than for consumer credit. Financial theorists have shown both theoretical and demonstrated real-world advantages of financial intermediation in the classic form for business lending. These largely revolve around the fact that businesses represent complex credits, or many of them do, and that the costs of evaluating, monitoring, and disciplining business borrowers create strong incentives for broad long-term relationships, which I believe would be difficult to reconcile with the securitization approach that's at the core of limited purpose banking. I believe that business credit could become significantly less available and substantially more expensive. Another whole thing is contingent commitments. This overlaps somewhat with the point I just made. Because you're looking at having any commitment be backed completely 100% with cash or something of equivalent value, there's not really room for things like lines of credit. Large businesses in particular very heavily use lines of credit. They find it very valuable for their financial planning. These are commitments where a bank says, we won't give you the money now unless you ask for it, but we will agree that over the next 3 years, if you need the money, and as long as you still live with certain conditions, it's going to be there for you. That's in fact the way that most large business banking is done these days, are these contingent commitments. Whereas, at least as I read the book, it would appear that any such commitment has to be backed dollar for dollar by funds in the bank. This would impose high costs on lines of credit by requiring funds to be held idle. And this is no small matter because, as I said, the majority of large business loans are contingent. And it's not just businesses. Individuals take out home equity lines of credit, and these have been misused and abused. But the basic idea that you be able to borrow on your house under certain conditions is a useful one. Now, there's a key reason that banks do these and other institutions don't. Mutual funds are not willing to do it. Capital markets are not willing to do these contingent commitments. And I can talk about that in Q&A if you want. But this seems to me a demonstrated area where banks provide a service that others are not particularly willing to do. I also have a host of problems with the insurance provision that was described. And this is an area of particular expertise of mine, so I've focused on it. And I do mean I have a host of difficulties, but in the interest of time, let me focus on two of those. First, there is real value in providing individuals with a clear policy with a known payoff. And I'm not convinced that the limited purpose banking proposal makes it possible to get to a reasonable facsimile of this without creating a host of adverse selection and other classic insurance problems. Now, to be clear, Professor Kotlikoff deals with this issue. I just don't believe the way he describes it would work, or at least not effectively. Second, I've actually structured and sold securitizations related to insurance risk. It's much harder and more expensive than you would think reading the book. It may be that at some point well in the future we can get past that. I do believe these insurance securitizations make sense, but we're far from a point where they would work as was implied. And all in all, I suspect there's only a portion of the insurance industry that could be converted to the limited purpose banking form, and I'm not sure it would be better than simply a reformed version of our present insurance system, even if we could. Now, that's an incomplete list of my issues, but I want to now come back to address the point that I think many of the causes of the crisis would still be here in limited purpose banking, at least in very substantial extent. So let me review some of the causes. There's the moral hazard created by institutions that are too big to fail. Now, I will give him an A on that one. We could still have economy-wide problems due to a financial market failing, but we wouldn't have to worry nearly as much about the need to bail out a bank or their equivalent in the mutual fund. I would, however, argue that too big to fail, while important, was a relatively small cause of the crisis we just went through. It amplified it somewhat, but it wasn't the major thing happening. Just as a very quick point, because I know this is counterintuitive with what you're reading in the paper all the time and what many theorists are saying, but let's say that we had taken Citigroup and broken it up into 15 pieces and Bank of America into 12 pieces. They all would have still made massive bets on mortgages. They all would have been doing securitizations that were opaque. They all would have had the same perverse incentive structures, et cetera. So, yes, we take care of too big to fail to a considerable extent with Professor Kotlikoff's approach, and I want to give him credit for that. Similarly, system-wide liquidity problems would be handled pretty effectively if the approach works as advertised. It would work because investors would only put money into funds that had liquidity characteristics that they could live with, and there wouldn't be a separate financial intermediary liquidity issue because financial intermediaries would always be fully funded. But I have to say the liquidity issue is one of the easiest things to fix about the present system and is being addressed now by regulators in a manner I believe will be effective. So it's good that this proposal takes care of it, but there are a lot of other ways to do it. Perverse compensation incentives. I don't see any major improvement here. Now, greater transparency on the investment side might help because we could more easily judge. But I'm not even convinced the total level of transparency would be all that much higher simply because of going to limited purpose banking. Now, he has suggested other things that would increase transparency, all of which could be done under the present system. So they're not intrinsic to limited purpose banking. Basically, underlying credits that are simple are already not a problem. Complex underlying credits aren't going to be simplified by running it through the mutual fund process. Bubbles. This clearly was one of the biggest problems. Bubbles, imbalances, excessive leverage system-wide, however you want to look at it. I don't see any major improvement here either. The vast majority of the market bought into the story that housing was worth the inflated prices. And we know from things like the tech bubble that mutual fund investors are not immune to fads. Additionally, government actions helped fuel the housing bubble, as well as other bubbles, and there doesn't appear to be anything intrinsically in limited-purpose banking that would stop that. Finally, bad regulation. A lot of regulation would simply go away because it wouldn't be needed under limited-purpose banking. But the approach does rely on the government, as has already been described, to do a number of new essential activities. The government would be very heavily involved in vetting things, effectively rating things either directly or through intermediate or through outsourcing it. And in the interest of time, I'll just say I think this is a lot harder and more complex than was implied unless we eliminate a number of the more complex products. But, of course, if we eliminated a number of the more complex products, the present system would be much safer, too. There'd be trade-offs, but in terms of safety, we'd clearly be safer. So I'm running out of time. In brief, I find the professor's ideas theoretically interesting, but for the most part impractical and possibly dangerous if taken as a whole in their present form. But it'll be interesting to see what we might be able to do refining this further. Thank you.
Thank you very much. What I'd like to do is, rather than turn it immediately over to Larry, is give a chance to our participants here to raise any questions, make any comments, and then come back to the panel. And Larry, you certainly get a chance to respond.
Okay, good.
In due course.
Sounds like back in
the- yes, in the back. Please introduce yourself. Sorry, I should have said.
David Trott, the IIF. The mutual fund thing I just find is not plausible for all the reasons Doug mentioned and a bunch of other reasons as well. However, I query whether it does not point up a flaw in the regulatory reform, which is that there's a substantial penalization of securitization and any number of new obstacles being thrown in the path of securitization. Would it not make sense to permit and encourage, indeed, a vastly increased amount of securitization to allow banks to continue to function with traditional Medici type maturity transformation, but get the assets off the books faster, more effectively, and therefore maintain the lending capacity that the present reforms may well squelch.
Okay, good. Take a couple more, then. Any other comments or reactions? Yes, sir.
Rain Wood from the Economic Policy Journal. I was interested in some of your comments, Doug, especially on your third point about the underestimating the risk of transition, because it seems like one of the risks is going from a fractional banking system into this limited purpose banking system. Obviously, that would have some effects on the availability of credit, as you mentioned, and the velocity of money and so forth. So can you guys comment on your third point there as well?
Sure. I'll comment briefly, and then I'm sure that Professor Kalikov will want to address some of these issues. He raises some of them in the book. I just think that he underestimates how badly it could blow up if it turns out that we have some trouble adjusting. I mean, one very basically that you already touched on is right now the Fed kind of knows how to do monetary policy with the present tools. They would be able to do monetary policy with this new approach. In some ways, it's a more direct lever. But if they get a bigger effect or a smaller effect than they would have thought they should, I could certainly see some problems. Especially you could end up with some where, say, overreacting and then underreacting and then working that out. I'm, as more of a financial institutions expert, I'm more focused on things like credit availability, where I think there could be a real issue.
Anybody else? If not, I will turn it over to Larry. Larry, go ahead, please.
Well, yeah. Thanks, Doug and others, for your reactions, thoughtful reactions. I don't agree with the gist of them, though. The Let me start with maturity transformation. What I was trying to get across at the beginning is that in order for maturity transformation to really, maturity transformation is a code word for ensuring people against getting a low rate of return because they need to get their money out right away from the financial system. Well, but even before the debacle that we had, it wasn't like we were getting great rates of return on our short-term deposits that we were getting paid, anything that would really suggest that this maturity transformation is really paying off a lot. But the other thing about the theory of maturity transformation is it relies on, as postulated by Diamond and Didvik in their classic paper, is it relies on the government's ability to have real purchasing power deposit insurance, not nominal deposit insurance, and it also relies on the aggregate economy not falling in terms of declining real terms when you have a bank run. Neither of those conditions are satisfied in the real world. We saw a series of bank runs, or effective bank runs, in the last couple of years. We saw the aggregate economy, the world economy, decline. And we also have seen in many countries where they have had deposit insurance, we've seen runs on the bank because the people understand that the deposit insurance is nominal. It's not real. If you talk to Domingo Cavallo and you ask what happened after the peso peg was lifted in 2002, and the government said, your deposits in peso, you're no longer going to be paid off in dollars, but you're going to be paid off in pesos. Don't run because we're going to make good your peso deposits. We'll print whatever you need to, you'll be able to get your pesos out at any time. People ran on the banks. Most of the big banks failed in Argentina because people realized that there was going to be hyperinflation or high inflation, and they wanted to get their money out and buy things real, like glasses, desks. So we are, as a country, engaged in third world policy. We are not used to third world situations, but we're not any different than a third world country in terms of the policy we're running right now. And we have to start thinking about things from a third world perspective, because that's what we're doing. We're behaving like a third world country. So consequently, we have to understand that third world countries have runs on banks, even though they have deposit insurance. The other thing about maturity transformation, I think it's highly overrated in terms of what it's actually delivering. But the other thing about it is that the theory says, subsequent to Diamond Didvik, there were articles written about the fact that by holding portfolios of long insured assets, people could achieve the same potential maturity transformation advantages, the same insurance basically through security markets by holding different assets that were out there in the marketplace, that you don't need to have this banking system set up that in effect is being subsidized by the government, because the government is providing. The reason we have this structure is that the government has set things up to provide in effect insurance for free, but it's insurance that they really can't provide in the end. If push comes to shove, this government cannot guarantee and insure in real terms, in purchasing power terms, everything it's committed to. Back in July, Nir Borofsky, who's the watchdog for Congress for TARP, testified that the government had made $24 trillion in new commitments over the course of this crisis. $24 trillion is more than two times national income. There's no way this government could come up and come up with two times national income and really deliver on its promises. So the government has become AIG to the power 10, in my estimation, and has made the situation much more risky than I think we really are appreciating in this conversation. There was a question asked about the transition and whether there be availability of credit. Well, credit is not generated by banks. There's just a myth here that the banks are somehow critical to credit. The credit is this. The way credit works in fundamental terms is that Yuri's a young guy who's got a lot of corn. This period, he's earned a lot of corn. And I'm a young guy, and my corn's coming in next period. I'm going to work and earn money when I'm old. Yuri's working when he's young. He's got the credit. He's got the corn that he can lend to me, and then I can pay him back. And whether or not we have this kind of financial intermediary between us or this kind, it's still Yuri's corn that I'm trying to get a hold of, and we'll pay him back later. So you have to think about things in real terms. You can easily get mixed up in the nominal, the money. You know, I could pay for this corn with dollars, and then he could lend me that corn back, those dollars back, and I could lend those dollars back to him, and he could lend them back to me, and we could have this money multiplier, lending multiplier go through over and over and again. It has nothing to do with the physical reality of the fact that his corn is coming into my mouth, and the rest of his corn he's planting, and some of it he's consuming. So if you look at this in physical terms, you get to see that you can easily, the money multiplier is not critical. The velocity of money is not an issue here. Money's going to get very, very, the velocity of money is going to get very, very high if we don't get our financial house in order and our fiscal house in order, because we're just going to be printing money out the wazoo, and people are going to realize that money is not going to be worth much, and they're going to treat it as a hot potato. That's when the velocity of money really takes off. That's the danger of the current system, not of of the transition to what I'm talking about. The transition to what I'm talking about takes the entire risk of this financial enterprise that we've got and tosses it out the window. It takes Uncle Sam's head out from under the fiscal and financial sword of Damocles, which he's put himself under. That's what the current situation is. Now, so I don't think much of this argument about maturity transformation, and I don't really think Doug Diamond thinks much of it either at this point, because I don't think he's pushing, and I push Phil, you know, I've discussed this stuff with Diamond and Didvik personally, and I don't see any strong response back when I say, look, you guys are requiring real deposit insurance and you don't have it in the real world, and you're requiring your economy to be invariant to the run, and it's not. And what happens is that what happened to this economy is it wasn't the $2 or $3 trillion in toxic assets that led the economy down the tubes. That's trivial. What happened was the psychology shifted. Everybody decided there was now going to be bad times because of the panic, because of the financial collapse. It was the specter of these big institutions collapsing that changed people's mentality and flipped us from a good equilibrium to a bad one, and we can just sit there for the next 20 years, just like the Japanese have managed to sit in a bad equilibrium for 20 years, or we can get our house in order and get to a safe place and change the psychology and get people back to work. So this is what the way I see things. I don't see this as a classic ISLM problem or a shock to the productivity coefficient in a real business cycle framework. I view this as a problem of coordination failure, big time. And we can have that happen tomorrow. And we may not get out of this quasi-recession that we're in now, regardless of how the National Bureau characterizes it. We've got 15 million people unemployed. And now Doug raises the question about credits for businesses and broad long-term relationships. So the title of this book is about Jimmy Stewart is dead. Jimmy Stewart's this honest banker in what's the name of the town that he was in the movie? I forget the Bedford Falls. Yeah, that's right. And his bank was Bailey Savings and Loan, and he was the small-town banker, and he knew everybody in the town. He knew all the businesses. He had all that information. Let me tell you about my local bank in Lexington, Massachusetts. It used to be Bay Bank. Then it turned into Fleet Bank. Then it turned into Bank of Boston. Today it's Bank of America. It's not exactly a small bank. My local bank is a multinational company. And that multinational company has a clerk inside that bank. And that clerk knows me from Adam. He's been there for six weeks. And he could care less about me. He's plugging my little business. If I go in for a loan, I have a little business as a software company. If I go in and ask for money, he's going to plug me into a computer program. I went into Cambridge Trust. I have two bank accounts. Cambridge Trust is a local bank in the sense that they stayed local. And I started my account there with them back in 1973 when Yuri and I first went to grad school together. And I walked into that bank and asked them for a loan for my little company, and they treated me, even though I was a customer of that bank for decades, they treated me just like anybody else, and they didn't spend any particular time trying to understand my business. They were just interested in what I was going to put up for collateral against this loan. Was I going to put my house up as collateral against this loan? And you know, that's the kind of the system we have today. I think that highly complex credits that are being negotiated at high fees by companies like J.P. Morgan in complicated transactions with big companies where J.P. Morgan says, we're going to manage the risk. These things, you know, yes, I agree that there are complicated credits like that out there, loans, and that they may not arise under limited purpose banking. And I think that's pretty much all to the good. I think we need to get to a simpler set of commoditized lending securities, loan securities, that can find a competitive price. I'm trying to save Main Street from Wall Street. I'm also trying to save Wall Street from itself. I'm trying to save Wall Street from Pennsylvania Avenue here, and from, because I think Congress is about to impose oversight on Wall Street that won't let it really function particularly well with 1,300 pages of who knows what exactly in terms of restrictions of their behavior. So when you have, I'm trying to get something simple, efficient, transparent, that works. I think we're heading to something that's not going to provide any real transparency, that's going to still leave our economy at enormous risk, and that's going to also eliminate the advantages that Wall Street still has in terms of trying to intermediate. So I don't put much faith in this, in these business relationships, to tell you the truth. I think I have a brother-in-law who works for J.P. Morgan. He's one of the most honest people I can imagine. He's a terrific banker. He's involved in these very big negotiations. I talked to him about the way these things are structured, and he says, well, you know, I talked to him about the risk exposure to the bank. He says, well, we manage the risk. He tells me how they're trying to manage the risk. And I say, well, you know, what if this risk management that you're doing blows up? He says, well, then it blows up. The taxpayer is really on the hook. I want to set up a system where the taxpayer is not on the hook. And I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, to tell you that, you know, I'm not coming at this from any ideological position, to tell you the truth. Let me just say a couple last things. Bubbles certainly will arise in this economy that I'm proposing we have, as they do in the current system. But we've had bubbles arise and collapse without systemic collapse of the financial system, without major recessions. We saw with the dot-com bubble, the stock market, or the NASDAQ, certainly fell in half, or actually three-quarters, I think, in value. Lots of people lost lots of money. People are used to losing money and making money in financial markets that are marked to market where there's no fraud. What happened here was fraud. So we need transparency, we need simplicity, and we need to turn the lights on Wall Street so that it's safe. And yeah, we're not going to have immunity from bubbles. We're not going to have immunity from real economic shocks. What we're going to do is get rid of the man-made fragility, the man-made shocks that have arisen in this crisis and have arisen in the past in the 30s and have arisen even before those in prior crises. So let me stop there.
Yeah. Why don't you just – it's terrific, but I want to hear if there are other comments and questions before we go much further. Anybody Anybody else? Yes, sir. Please introduce yourself.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort
please,
of...
Please introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm John Beale. I'm actually a diplomat, but my previous life was in the financial services, the World Bank and Chase Manhattan Bank. What I don't understand, really, I'm just wondering if too far east is not west. You mentioned lots of interesting things. For me, I haven't read your book, and these are new concepts to me. But what I would say is that what happened, as I understand it, in this country, is that all reasonableness and all common sense, or any reasonable banking went. I went through the Chase Manhattan Bank School, and I'm actually shocked to think what took place here. It could not have happened from what I learned in the Chase School. What I mean to say is that surely when you make a loan to someone, I like to look you in your eyes, but a lot of these loans were made by the bank never even, doesn't even know their customer, and they based it on information by somebody who is getting a large commission on the bigger the loan. And you know, life is very simple to some extent. If something sounds too good to be true, it's not true. And you just have to have a simple thing is if the other guy has nothing to lose, you can be darn sure that that's not a transaction to be in. So I'm just, you know, really wondering what took place here. And you mentioned about other countries, developing nations with the banking system. The banking systems that I've come across in Brazil and even in small countries and whatnot, have improved substantially over the years, and I don't see the defaults there. I mean, in this country, you've had, 55 banks fail this year already? But it is to my mind, out of greed and simply bad management. And I'm just wondering, how do you correct that? I mean, and in your system there, I just wondered, you seem to try to eliminate all risk. I mean, I don't believe you can completely eliminate all risk anyway.
I'm not eliminating risk. I'm keeping the middlemen from gambling with our money. And the middlemen are just going to be utility companies. They're going to intermediate. That's their purpose in life. Their purpose is not to gamble with the taxpayers' chips. That's the reality. And pretend that they can keep us safe, pretend they can manage our risk, which they can't, and then leave us with 15 million people unemployed. That would stop.
Right. Let me, any other points? I mean, I'll just make a quick comment here. Of course, the banking crisis is not a new phenomenon, right? I mean, we know from the history books that we had banking crisis going back to the times that banks were begun in any recognizable form, you know, back in Florence, for example, in the Stefano will remind me, in the 16th century, you had a very substantial banking crisis. So this is not a new phenomenon. And the concept of fractional banking just arises very naturally all over the world in all sorts of markets because the profit opportunity exists to gather a lot of deposits in, put in a little bit of equity, lend a lot of money, and make a buck on the difference. The problem is that, and what Larry is underlining is, yes, you have maturity transformation, you have contingent commitments, you have business relationships that are all part of the value added of this industry. But what Larry is saying is, you know, if once every 20 years I get a crisis that, according to the International Monetary Fund, has lowered the output of the United States permanently by 10%, okay? Now, 10% permanent reduction in the output of the United States equals something like 2.5% of 2.5 times today's GDP, if you simply take the present value of that. Right or wrong? 2.5 times GDP.
That's a big number.
It's indeed a big number. So what Larry is saying is the game is not worth the candle. And that's the essence of the argument. And then the other side of the argument is We actually nowadays, partly because of the information technologies we have better ways. We can do it more directly. We can provide a lot of these services without this extraordinary risk or unbelievable leverage that is intrinsically built into these institutions, because that's the way they make money, is through the leverage. So that's the argument, and I think the issue is, the fundamental issue is the proposal credible? Is it workable? Can it really deliver? And this is where the difference is. I think it's a very, very interesting discussion.
It already is delivering in so far as a third of the financial system is mutual funds, and they are extending credit, and they are, intermediating.
Stefan. Introduce yourself, Stefan.
Stefan Gutkacz, Central Bank of England. I haven't read the book, but it's a really fascinating subject. I mean, there are a lot of discussion everywhere in the world, namely between in Europe and in the United States. But I have a very simple question. How would you see a competition between a system, central limited purpose banking, and others based on universal banking? The question is, how competitive is a system like that with other systems that are, traditionally based on universal banking? I mean, what are the elements of this comparison?
Well, I think that if the U.S. adopted this, other countries would follow suit. So I think it's an interesting question, but I'm not sure it's, that important in terms of evaluating this. If I can go to a German bank and set up an account where the German government is providing me free insurance, and there's lots of states of nature in which they would actually pay off, and we wouldn't have a colossal run, then why not take advantage of some free insurance that a government has set up? See, I think I'm a little bit more I think that our system is the way it is, in large part because the moneyed interest have paid the politicians to create this system and to prolong it. When you spend $3 billion on Congress before leading up to the repeal of Glass-Steagall in the late 90s, it's a lot of money. Okay, I think that we have these institutions not because they're the most efficient, but possibly because they're the most profitable for the people who are in a position to bribe people. I think there's basic corruption here. I think the system we have is basically corrupt. I think you have banks promising to do things they can't deliver. You've got insurance companies promising to do things they can't deliver, and you've got the government promising to do things they can't deliver. And if I'm in the U.S. investing in mutual funds that are, I understand, and they're transparent, and it's a system that works, and I'm thinking about, should I go to this third country and invest there, where this kind of corruption is basically underway? Well, I would think twice about it. I'd say I prefer, a lower rate of return, that I'm safer, that I'm more assured will actually pay off. I don't want a state of the nature where I lose all my money over in that other country. Iceland's a good example. Would I invest these days in, if Iceland started doing what it did again, what it had done again, would I put money in an Icelandic bank? No.
Okay.
Go
ahead, and then Doug, and then I think we'll close it.
Few
it.
Several banking system based on universal banking concept that proved to be much more resilient than systems based on specialized banks. And there has been a big debate in late 80s in comparison to
course, not limited purpose bank, but specialized institution, divided, controlled by holdings, but with separate entities dealing with specialized credit. And in the end, the winner was the universal banking model. I think that the issue is not the model. That is my personal conviction, is not the model, is the way in which regulation, supervision, management.
Thank you. Okay, Doug, and then we'll close with any closing comments from, short closing comments from Larry.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I'll keep this short myself. Obviously, there are a lot of details that we could go on forever about, but just in terms of big picture, I think there would be real cost to this change, and not just the transition costs. I think you would have a safer system that was bought to some extent at a loss of economic efficiency, and I think you would have a shifting of variability from the financial intermediaries to individuals that I think has some cost. I think we could probably agree that some of these things could be empirically analyzed. I'd love to see that, because while I love the rather shocking statistic you were giving about the permanent 10% decline, but let's say that I'm right in my gut feeling that over the last 40 years, we would have had even 0.25% a year lower growth by going to a safer system. I mean, I believe we ought to go to a safer system, but by going to an ultra-safe system. By the way, ignoring compounding, 0.25% a year for 40 years gets you to the same 10% lower. So it's not obvious that just because this crisis has produced this huge hit, that means that a system that could have, when done badly, allowed us to get there was in total the wrong system.
Good point.
Well, once again, thanks so much for setting this up, and Doug for your comments. I think there's lots. GDP is just one measure of our welfare. We've clearly destroyed a lot of people's retirements. We've destroyed a lot of people's jobs. We've destroyed a lot of people's psychologies through this crisis, and we've put a huge amount of risk on the next generation. So, and that transfer of generational risk is not being measured in our GDP statistics. It could be that Uncle Sam makes a profit as it defines it on these transactions, but right now he's implicitly committed to trillions of dollars of obligations when the next crisis hits, which could be tomorrow. So I think we need to realize that we have an obligation to the next generation to set up a safe system, that the economy is not really going to function well when nobody can trust anybody. When you look at the 1,300 pages, there's nothing really about transparency, disclosure. That's not page one in this new reform. There was basically a sale of snake oil. It has nothing to do really with being too big to fail or prop trading. That's not really at the heart of the problem, or whether they were investment banks or commercial banks. They were all engaged in this. So we've got reform going on that's not really addressing the core problem, which is selling things that aren't honest. And that's going to continue unless we really get to the heart of the problem. And that's what limited purpose banking would do. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I think it's been a small group, but I think it's been a very lively discussion, and I must say a very informed one. I'm delighted that you were able to be here, and I'm sure you want to join me in thanking our panelists.